We came through Scalthorpe, and there were vehicles all over the runway.
Yeah.
You overthrew the runway with the gear down. They cleared off.
Yeah. They panicked off the runway.
They panicked off the runway.
Yeah. And I came in and landed, and they sent out a follow-me truck, which I followed into a parking place where the American top sergeant there, who was a Negro, as a matter of fact, and he asked me what was the matter with the airplane. I told him I had no radios and probably only about 100 pounds of fuel in it. And he says, well, Lieutenant, we'll look after that. And I went up to operations, the American colonel there, and he asked me what my problems were, and I told him, and he said, we'll look after it. And so then I asked him if there's any place where I get some lunch, because I didn't have any money. All I had was a flying suit on and my underwear underneath and nothing else. And he said, here, I'll lend you $10. So he lent me $10 in the script, and I went and had lunch, came back, and he said, your airplane's ready. So I said, okay. I said, we have a bit of a problem here. He says, your airplane evidently doesn't have a frequency for our tower. I said, that's correct. And he says, well, how are we going to let you take off here? And I said, well, there's no problem there. Have you got a red or a green light in the tower? And he says, well, yes. And I said, well, give me a green light when I can taxi and give me a green light when I can take off. And he says, but you've got to file an alternative airport here. And we weren't used to filing alternate airports or anything else. So I said, well, West Raynham, they've got a 00 GCA. How's that sound? He said, well, that sounds good to me. So I went down to the airplane, and there's the same American top sergeant standing there. And I greeted him, and I said, how's the airplane? He says, fine, the radio's fixed, working good. We fueled her all up, and she's ready to go. And we're standing there looking at the airplane, and I says, good. I said, well, let's get a starter here. I'm going to take off. And he says, you're going to what? And this cloud was still down at 150 feet or so, you know. And he says, you all going to take off in this here weather? I said, yep. He said, you all going to take off in this here weather in this here airplane? At which time he's rolling his eyes skyward, you know. And I said, yep. And he says, just shook his head, and I climbed in and fired it up and got the green lights and took off and went back to base.
Off you go.
Yeah. But that was the type of flying that we did over there.
Yeah.
Bernie Ebern, a buddy of mine one day, was a little short of fuel coming back to base. We used to run them pretty dry in those days.
Mm-hmm.
We were flying probably without drop tanks. And so your endurance is a max of maybe 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to get to what you were doing and back to base, and you might have 30,000 feet of cloud in between you to do that kind of stuff. Bernie one day was low on fuel and got lost out over East Anglia. And in East Anglia, there's probably an airport every 5 miles, just about, wartime airports. And a lot of them were abandoned, disused, and a lot of them had haystacks at that time right down the runway. The guy had mown all the hay, and he stacked it up on the runway in little stacks. Bernie landed on this airport, and I don't know how many haystacks he ran down, but it was quite a few. We had to send a truck out there to take some fuel out to him. And he used the same path he landed to take off again, because the haystacks were mown down.
Pretty tough airplane.
Yeah, pretty tough airplane. Norm Ronison one time was on the squadron at that time. Norm Ronison did all the test flying on Canadair's jet aircraft there, the passenger job. In fact, he was killed in it. He got into a spin, I guess, or deep stall. And he got everybody out of the airplane. They all bailed out, but he went in with the airplane, and so he died.
Mm.
But Norm was up one day, and he was doing a letdown. We did a letdown controlled by the control tower, CRDF letdown, we called it. And that would bring you on to an approach for GCA. Well, the CRDF controller was controlling the wrong airplane. And he had one airplane on the scope, and he was talking to a different one. And so Norm Ronison got let down through the cloud quite a bit south of Luffenham. And the only place he could land, because he was out of fuel, was a grass strip. Mm. And he landed the F-86 on the grass strip.
Mm.
And they took it off from the grass strip, too. So it was quite an airplane.
Quite an airplane.
He was lucky.
Yep.
We used to do exercises in England called rats and terriers.
Hmm.
Now, rats and terriers, or we usually did this on the weekend, and it was to exercise the RAF auxiliary.
Mm-hmm.
They're airplane spotters, you know, like the Home Guard and all of those kind of guys, and the weekend pilots. Now, we would go out over the North Sea, get right down on the water, and come in and penetrate the coast going into Leicester or someplace like that, simulating strike bombers or fighter bombers or whatever. And the Royal Observer Corps, sitting on their little platforms along the coast, would spot us. And this was all World War II stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they would phone into sector, I suppose, that they'd spotted four airplanes on course such and such at such and such a height. Then they would scramble the RAF auxiliary, who were flying Meteors and Vampires at that time, I suppose, which were Mach 8 airplanes. And so we used to keep the speed. We were supposed to stay well below Mach 8,
mm-hmm.
so they had a chance to catch us.
Yeah.
Well, we would ride it at about Mach 7, 8, which is pretty close. And at Mach 8, the Meteors and the Vampires just started having control problems. And so we would edge it up as soon as we saw them coming to about 8.5 or so. And then they would queue up behind you, because this is the only time they ever got to queue in behind an F-86. And then we'd go on a merry chase across the England.
Yeah.
Generally like a pylon race, you know, down below the smokestacks and around them. And these guys would be following behind us. There was a fellow named John Ratcliffe who was in the RAF. John, I met after he joined the RCAF.
Mm-hmm.
And he was at McDonald, Manitoba when I was a flying instructor there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling this story about the rats and terriers one day and how we used to try and wipe them off on smokestacks, because in order for them to shoot us down with their film, they would have to lead us. So if we're flying around a smokestack, all of a sudden this guy sees a big smokestack in front of his nose. And it's disconcerting, so to speak. John Ratcliffe said, "You're the son of a gun that did that to me, are you?" So we checked our logbooks, and it was indeed I that did that. And it was John that was following me, and he had since left the RAF and joined the RCAF.
Yeah.
John was on the, the flight out of Ottawa that used to fly the brass around in the jets.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So when you're telling stories, sometimes they come back at you.
Yep, that's right. So we talked earlier, and I want to bring us back to the Soviet Air Force and the fledgling East German Air Force were flying around the inner German border.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that there was a certain separation between you, and you had the pieces to keep your guns from firing.
Yep.
But were there ever either Canadian or American engagements along those with the...
We used to hear stories.
Okay.
Yeah. stories about aircraft exploding at a high altitude above 50,000 feet and thought to be a U-2 coming back or something like that and being nailed by the Russians.
Hmm.
I used to fly in the Mark 5.
Mm-hmm.
I've had sections at 54,000 feet, which was pretty high. I've even had the bends at those altitudes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a pressure suit.
No, we didn't have a pressure suit. The cabin was pressurized, but we didn't have pressure suits, no. But 54,000 feet was pretty, you know, you're on the edge of your flight envelope. And it was ideal up there in that there's no contrails.
Mm-hmm.
And I would fly at that altitude to pick on the boys below.
Mm-hmm. But did, now, could you go higher?
That was about the limit with the Mark V.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So none of the Canadians that you knew were involved in any of these getting across the border?
No.
Now, one of the things that comes up in Cold War studies a lot is the intelligence that Canadian aircrew had about the opposing forces. What do you recall about what you knew about who the other side was?
Well, we were... I don't know how to attack that one. We studied the enemy aircraft. We knew what a MiG could do and what it couldn't do. I had talked to Korea pilots in the RCF that had flown against the MiGs, and we understood that. I was a pilot attack instructor. In other words, I took a course on target recognition and all of this sort of thing. And there was about four or five guys on the course, five or six, maybe more than that, about 10, I guess so. And I guess the idea was to send all of the one pilot attack instructor to each squadron.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's about five of us ended up on one squadron. So, a little ridiculous. But we learned all the target recognition stuff on the enemy equipment and aircraft and all the rest of it. Air tactics, especially against the MiG, which was the aircraft at that time, and the battle formations and the way we used to fly them. We used to play around now and again with the fighter leader school out of, I guess it was West Raynham, RAF.
Oh, yeah.
And they used to fly against us with their Meteors and Vampires, I guess, practicing their tactics as they would against MiGs, I suppose.
Because the F-86 in appearance was similar to some of the MiGs.
Yeah, the F-86 was a swept-wing aircraft and could get up to Mach 9.7 on a cruise, no problem at all. And the Meteors and the Vampires, of course, were straight-wing Mach 8 airplanes.
Sure.
So the RAF had a certain way of evading attacks. I think they used those in Korea and they didn't work very well, type of thing. So they eventually got F-86s and other airplanes.
Yep. And was this all in the days before missiles? So guided either infrared missiles? The Sabre, did the Canadian Sabre ever have infrared guided missiles?
No. No.
And not radar missiles?
No, it was pre-missile.
Pre-missile?
Yeah.
The
I guess the missiles, the Sidewinder came along probably first time would be Taiwan and China.
Mm.
And they were using them at that point.
And then Vietnam.
And then, of course, Vietnam, yeah.
Well,
yeah. The kill ratio in Korea, I believe, was about 7-1 F-86s against MiGs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in Taiwan it went up to 13 or 14-1, which probably is the Sidewinder missile.
Sure. Did you have an intelligence officer or someone who on your squadron, intelligence sergeant?
Yeah. Intelligence officer, he was a flight lieutenant, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Got a picture of him somewhere, cloak and dagger. they presented him with a cloak and dagger when he left the base.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And was he, would you say that he was a professional intelligence officer? Was he a navigator doing that job?
No, I think he was a professional intelligence officer.
Mm-hmm.
He did the debriefings after all of our exercises, and he was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
We used to do a lot of exercises against Canberras.
Hmm.
Canberra would be flying very high. I think their altitude record was 63,000 feet or so. But we would intercept them, and we would do an attack on them. Canberra had no defense. It was unarmed, so to speak. It didn't have a tail gun. And we would attack them dead on the stern and shoot them down every time.
Yeah.
But they could outclimb us. If they saw us coming. We would attack them, but the Canberra could start going up like an elevator. And we had difficulty with them then. But lower down, no. Take them out.
And did you learn that from the intelligence guys or from the...
From the rest of the pilots.
From the rest of the pilots.
And, of course, you would get briefed by the wing commander, you know, CIOPSO and all the rest of it. But he would interrogate us on what kind of attacks we used and all the rest of it.
Would you see him fairly often? Was he a member of the squadron?
No. He was part of operations.
NATO was formed in 1949 and the Warsaw Pact was formed in response in May of 55. Tell me your impressions of NATO and the Warsaw Pact from your point of view as a Sabre pilot in NATO.
Well, we thought we were supreme. We weren't too worried about them at all.
They were... how were you supreme?
We had better airplanes, I think, better training.
Was there a sense... Go ahead.
Of course, we never had to prove that. So, in hindsight, it might have been a little different. I don't know. You know, when you're young and foolish.
Flying a good jet.
Yeah, flying the best one in the world, we figured. Or the propaganda had us believing that.
There was a, was there a sense, though, that the your RCAF squadrons were now under some other sort of management hierarchy or chain of command?
Not really.
You knew where your orders were coming from?
Yeah. Even when we were in England, it was RAF, but it was still NATO, so to speak. And it was pretty seamless. We used to go back and forth from England to Germany all the time, you know, on a weekend or whatever, which was nice in those days. You could just take an F-86 and go.
Good little sports car.
Well, you're right.
Were there sports cars on the base? Or
oh,
on the
lots of them.
What kind of sports cars?
Oh, they had, what the heck they have now? MGs?
Yeah.
Kenny Branch had a 1935 MG with wire spoke wheels, a drop head coupe. I had a Volkswagen, which cost $1,500. That was the Volkswagen Deluxe because it had hydraulic brakes.
Your next two postings were back in Canada.
Yep.
Tell me about your duties as a training officer on the T-33 at McDonald.
I went to McDonald, and I went there as a pilot weapons attack instructor. And I taught gunnery, dive bombing, skip bombing, all of that kind of stuff in T-33. And then they wound down the bombing, or the weapons attack business, and turned it into an AFS, Advanced Flying School. And so I became an advanced flying instructor and taught students directly off. At that time, they were still flying Harvards. And it was... You went from 180 hours in the Harvard, and then you went to T-33 for advanced flying. I did my advanced flying on the Harvard, of course, but so I was teaching advanced flying on the T-Bird.
And was McDonald closed while you were there, or did you manage to?
I was transferred out of there. I lost my flying category. Eyesight went on me, and I was grounded, and I had to fly with a qualified co-pilot and all this sort of thing. And then they transferred me to Claresholm Flying Training School.
Right.
Basic Flying Training School, where I was a flying adjutant there.
Okay. What did that entail?
And all the paperwork for a flying school. I had I had eight people in the early room, I guess, directly under me. And I reported to the wing commander flying.
So when a student arrived, or someone was moved into Claresholm, into the base, what sort of things, what sort of contact would you have with them?
Well, this was the flying training school. I wasn't the base adjutant at all.
Okay.
So the flying training school, there was 2, 4, 6, 8. I think it was 8 flights. Yeah, or six flights, 8 flights. And they all reported to the wing commander flying. And I was his adjutant, and I handled all the paperwork for all of the service stuff.
Okay.
And then we started closing down Claire's home, and I became personnel administrative officer, which was the adjutant to the CO of the station.
Mm.
So I was ended up, there was three officers on the station. There was me, and there was Spud Murphy, the supply officer, and there was Jim Coots, the accounts officer. Now, in the Air Force, supply officers and accounts officers can't hold inventories.
Mm.
So I held all the inventories on the station, which included all the sheets and airplanes and the whole bit. And so I had to look after that and make sure it was straight. I remember calling up Spud one day, and he was a supply, and I said, "Spud, I'm supposed to have so many sheets here, and I've only got half of them." And he says, "You've got a problem, haven't you?" And I said, "Yes, what do you suggest I do about it?" He says, "Well, if you tore them all in half, you'd have about the right number, wouldn't you?" I said, "Yeah, I guess so, but do I really have to tear them in half?" He said, "Well, I don't think so."
So why was Claire's home being closed?
Flying training was winding down. We didn't need the base. This was in the, I guess, Diefenbaker was coming in there, too. And that was basic flying training. They had chipmunks and Harvards at Claire's home.
Did you miss flying?
Oh, yeah. I did some flying after I got out of the Air Force. Little airplanes.
Yeah.
And even today, my son owns an airplane.
Yeah.
Which we fly around in now and again.
Yeah.
He's down in Ontario, but he's coming out here this summer with his airplane, so
we'll
do some flying.
So eventually you left the Air Force.
Yeah.
Tell me about the decision to leave the Air Force.
Well, it was their decision.
Yeah.
You see, I had a short service commission.
Okay.
And my eyesight was not that good, so my future in the Air Force didn't look that good either.
Right.
And I wasn't willing to push any more paper.
Yeah.
And so it was about time I had another career.
Was there any fanfare when you left?
No, there was hardly anybody there. Closing down Claire's home, yeah. I was at the close down of McDonald, too.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Claire's home at the time, but I flew down there.
Mm-hmm.
And this was called Black Friday at the Claire's home. Yeah, I walked in there, and the officers' mess, they had sawdust about that deep. And everybody
6 inches deep.
Yeah, and everybody wore flying suits. And then they had a greased pig contest. They brought a pig in from somewhere, and it was liberally greased up. And you had to catch this pig and lift it up off the ground to win something. I forget what it was now. But you can imagine a wild pig running through the mess there, and the sawdust is that deep, and he's got grease all over.
And terrified.
And terrified, yeah. One guy finally lifted the pig up, and I guess he was squeezing it around the middle. And that's when the pig decided to relieve himself. Got everybody. So that's quite a party.
Yeah, yeah. And that was for the close down of...
of McDonald.
Of McDonald.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Claire's home was still open when you were there.
Yeah.
For the,
well, I closed Claire's home down. There's two or three guards, I guess, when I left.
Yeah.
And that was about it.
So where did you take your release?
Officially from Calgary.
Huh.
That's what the paper says, but it was from Claire's home.
Yeah.
I jumped in the moving trailer, my car, and took off and came back to Victoria.
Yeah.
There was another story at Claire's home.
Uh-huh.
Claire's home was a NATO base, and we were training German pilots at that time.
Hmm.
And there was a colonel, air attaché from Ottawa, Colonel Schlitzschling, I think he was called. He was about 6'6", ramrod Prussian type. And my boss was Hank Malkin, Wing Commander Hank Malkin. Hank Malkin had started the war as a sergeant pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And through attrition, he was a bomber pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And through attrition, he ended up as being wing commander
mm-hmm.
on the bomber base. And he hated Germans because they were shooting at him when he was over the Ruhr all the time. Well, that carried over until after the war, too, and he wasn't too happy with German students. And Colonel Schlitzling arrived at the base, and we were going to have a mess dinner for him, which we did. We had the mess dinner, and then retired to the mess afterwards. And in the mess, the CO and the nursing sisters and everybody were promoting a pill. I called it an anti-hangover pill. And if you took one or two or three, that would greatly ease your hangover next morning. And so we had everybody taking these pills, and we finally convinced the German air attaché to take one too. In actual fact, these pills were kidney dye pills. And after the festivities were over and everybody went to bed, I picked up the staff car in the morning, and on the little staff there was a flag, a pair of panties with three stripes on it, a wing commander. So I drove up to the boss's barracks to pick him up, because we were going to pick up the German air attaché and take him down on the flight strip to put him in the expediter and send him back to Ottawa. And I said, gee, I better take those off. And he said, no, leave them on there. So we drove down to the barracks. I was driving the staff car. Hank Malkin was sitting in the back seat. And I pull up in front of the barracks. And Hank says, well, I better go in and get this guy. So in he goes. And I'm sitting in the staff car waiting, and there seems to be waiting a little while. But then I see the door open, and this German comes marching straight out, looking straight ahead. And Hank Malkin was probably about 10 paces behind him with a big grin on his face. And so they both got in the back seat of the staff car, and they weren't saying anything. So I just drove down to the tarmac there, and we unloaded the air attaché, and he got onto the expediter and slammed the door and took off. I turned to Hank and I said, what happened? And he says, well, I went in there, I knocked on the door, and I talked to the air attaché, and he was saying he's not feeling very well and that he was urinating bright red. So Hank had to explain to him that those were kidney dye pills, and he didn't think it was funny at all. So that's what happened, and we never heard from him again. No.
Tell me about how you ended up marrying in England, or you were serving in England when you got married.
Yeah. Well, I met Kay when I was at Portage La Prairie, I guess. The case from a farm just south of Portage, a place called Elm Creek. Mm-hmm. So, during all this time, I was going out with Kay and going down to the farm and meeting her folks and all of this sort of stuff, getting pretty serious. And then I was finished my training at McDonald, and I got shipped to England. Mm-hmm. And after I was over there for a while, I figured, well, I better do something about this. So I'd given her an engagement ring. So I sent her some money and told her to buy a boat ticket and a wedding ring. And so she did. Actually, Mick Fikowski, his girlfriend came across on the same boat, and the two girls knew each other.
Oh, good.
So they traveled across there. So Mick had to arrange a wedding, and I had to arrange a wedding.
And were those squadron affairs?
Oh, they were, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. And they were pretty good. So I arranged the wedding. I think it cost me $35 or something like that in total. I had to pay for the fruit that went into the fruit cake, for the wedding cake. I had to pay for the fruit, and I had to pay for the booze. And at that time, 40 ounces of rye cost $2.40. So you could go a long way on about $20 worth of booze. And we dragooned all the people into Matron of Honor, and Dean Kelly was my best man. I don't know if you've ever heard of Dean Kelly. Or he gave her away. Yeah.
Oh.
Jimmy Johnson was my best man, that's right. Dean Kelly gave her away, and it was a Jewish girl that was matron of honor.
Ola.
Ola, fine, yeah. And I'm supposed to be Protestant. Jimmy, I think, was RC. Didn't matter. We mixed it all up, and we had the wedding on the base. And then we spent our honeymoon in London. Went to all the theaters. I saw Guys and Dolls and a few shows like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then yes. all the moving around?
Yeah, there was a lot of moving around. Yeah. Packing up and going. We lived in a village in called Empingham in England. With a little old spinster. Her name was Miss Kidson. And she was a teacher, I guess. She used to teach English in Germany before the war type of thing. But she was a prim and proper little old English frump, you know. So we shared quarters with her.
Uh-huh. In those days, now, did the commanding officer have a wife?
Yeah.
And did you have to ask permission to get married?
Yep.
And was that a...
It was kind of like a blank check.
Yeah. How about the airmen? Did they have to ask permission to marry, or could they marry?
Yeah, they could marry, but I suppose they had to ask permission too. I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
But I imagine they would, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think a CO would ever say no to an officer?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah.
But I suppose he might say no if he... Some of these guys were taking out some pretty wild women, you know. And... he might say no to try and slow somebody up, I would think.
Yeah.
But if it came right down to it, I don't think any way he could say no.
No. And could the commanding officer, could he do a wedding? Could he do the wedding, or who did your wedding?
It was an RCF Pendry.
Oh, yeah.
John Littlewood, wasn't that his name, Kay?
Yeah.
Littlewood, yeah.
Pendry Littlewood.
Pendry Littlewood, yeah. We were married right on the station.
Yeah.
And... Mick Fikowski was RC. He was married off the station in the church. And we had a joint reception.
Oh, good.
The two of us together. So everybody got drunk at the same time.
What was the cost of fruit?
Fruit?
Was the cost of fruit and liquor?
Well, liquor was pretty cheap, yeah. Bernie Eburn, what the heck? We drove to Peterborough to catch the train to London. And Bernie Eburn had a little sports car. And the last time I saw him, he was driving along the sidewalk in Peterborough.
Huh.
So pedestrians were getting out of his way, you know.
And where were your kids born?
Oldest one was born in Germany.
Uh-huh.
Another one was born in Calgary.
Mm-hmm. No.
And Claire's home.
So real Air Force brat, sort of moving around.
Yeah, well, they were quite young at the time. Of course, I got out. I was quite young.
Oh, right.
Reasonably young.
What would you say that your memories are of the Air Force in broad terms?
Broad terms? Oh, it was a heck of a lot of fun. Learned a lot and flew some of the best airplanes in the world.
Yeah.
And still alive. Used to probably drive our wives nuts sometimes.
Yeah. And then what did you do after you left the Air Force?
Well, I'll tell you. I came back to Victoria. And I was looking for a job and having a hard job finding one because I was overqualified for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that was just an excuse, I don't know. But I hooked up with a guy named Charlie White. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie White Theater in Sydney.
Oh, yeah.
And Charlie White used to write fishing articles. He had a company called Salt Air Sea Products.
Okay.
And he designed crab traps. And at this time, Charlie was doing some charter fishing trips. And he had the president of Maytag one day to fish out in Brentwood there or someplace out there. And Charlie talked him into giving him the Maytag franchise for automatic laundries. You know these coin-operated laundries?
Yeah.
So there was Charlie at the franchise. And at that time, he just retired as the manager of Channel 6 here in Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
He's an American. He was originally from Portland, Oregon, where he set up that TV station.
Charlie White.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, I think when he was going to school, there used to be a radio program called Quiz Kids.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie was on standby for the Quiz Kids radio broadcast. He's,
so, Charlie Gott.
The franchise for Maytag washing machines and the automatic laundry deal for BC, I guess, or Western Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And they built the first one, which is still in existence on Cook Street, down by Beacon Hill Park there.
Oh, yeah.
That was the first one in Victoria. And our office, I went to work for Charlie at that point, and our office was in the back of that laundry. And Art Phillips, at that time, who became the mayor of Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
and then became, I think he became a member of parliament too, at one time.
Mm-hmm.
He had owned a big chunk of the All Canada, it was a mutual fund, in Vancouver, and he'd sold that, so he had $200,000. And Charlie knew him, and Art wanted to build some automatic laundry, so why, of course, we can do that for you, no problem at all. So I started in Victoria and basically looking for locations and organizing the construction of automatic laundries and getting all the approvals and all of this sort of thing. And I built these all the way up Vancouver Island, and I called them Pink Elephant Coin Laundries.
Ah.
You might have seen one somewhere.
You have, eh?
Okay, that was my brainchild.
Really?
And I built 13 of them on Vancouver Island. And ran them all, too.
Holy.
And so I was running up and down Vancouver Island with a little Vauxhall.
Uh-huh.
I'd collect the money out of these laundries. I'd probably have maybe $10,000 worth of coinage in the back end and in the trunk of a Vauxhall, and that car was driving like that with the nose up in the air and hard going around corners. And so I did that for a while, and then we expanded the distribution business to cover all of Canada, and I started moving and doing this Calgary and Winnipeg and on, so I was on the road again, moving and moving family and all this sort of thing. And then finally the government put surtaxes on American imports of dryers and things like this, and that killed our business pretty well. And Charlie sold out to some other people who didn't run the business very well, and I didn't happen to own a chunk of it, so I couldn't do anything about it, so it ended up going belly up.
Oh.
So I was into electronics then.
Yeah.
Into
what about, did anything in the Air Force prepare you to run a chain of coin laundries?
Yeah. The only thing was just sheer guts. But no formal education, no. No. Nobody had done it before. It was a challenge, yeah, just like flying airplanes. They'd done that before, but I hadn't done it before. But the building, the laundries, everything was from scratch.
Yeah.
I learned a lot of things. I learned that the sewers in Qualicum Beach were made out of wood with steel bands around them, yeah, or iron bands, I guess. And in Qualicum Beach, I had to build a septic field, which I'd never done before, to filter all this stuff out. In the later years, I learned that I destroyed a trout stream.
Oh.
It wasn't too good, but it didn't matter in those days.
Yeah. No. Lots of trout.
Yeah. And in Ladysmith, the sewer was above the level of the store, so I had to put a couple of pits in there to hold the water and sump pumps to pump it up and design all this kind of stuff as you're going along, you know.
Sure.
Kind of winging it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So, no, the Air Force didn't train me for it, but they did in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you didn't need your French profile or any of that French that you didn't do so well with in school. That didn't hold you back in the Maytag business.
No. It helped me out in France when I was ordering a beer, but that was about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we lived in a village, Vertun, there, and they spoke no English.
Yeah.
And so we had to try a few words.
Yeah. How many of the fellows you knew in the Air Force are in Victoria now?
Oh, I don't know. There's at least a good dozen or so, I suppose. Yeah.
From all the different bases that...
Yep.
Yeah. Do you ever hear from them or see them?
Mm-hmm. Don Miles eventually became... He was flying officer on 441 Squadron, And he eventually became the CO of 441 Squadron. I see him every month.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get hooked up with Rusey?
Through Air Force officers. Through Don Miles, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So you're saying after the Maytag business went belly up, you went into electronics?
Yeah, into distribution. Developed the car stereo business. And designed all the display units to set up in the stores, the retail outlets.
Mm-hmm.
And that was with Pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a pretty good job on that. Distributed those across the country. Then I went to work for another company in Toronto that handled all of the Pioneer merchandise, all the hi-fi equipment, and I handled half of Ontario, I guess, in sales mm-hmm. for that company.
Mm-hmm.
And did that kind of thing.
Yeah. Got just a couple minutes left. Here's a bit of a final question. This could lead to other questions. Did we win the Cold War?
I think it was, we did. I think the Americans did, yes.
The Americans did? By what measure?
The economic collapse of the Soviet Union.
Good.
Economic and political collapse.
Yeah.
Sure. That was it.
Not the military directly.
Well, indirectly it was military.
Yeah, the spending.
Certainly. The spending just bankrupted them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if the Americans are going to do that to us. By the look of it right now, they're trying to bankrupt us, take over.
Well,
I don't know if I'm still bound by the Official Secrets Act or not.
I don't know.
Probably am.
Probably.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a great pleasure interviewing you for the Oral History Project.
Well, I don't know if any of this is going to be of any use, but that's the way it was in those days.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.